Hello, and welcome to our next episode of Speak to It. I'm Daya Lai, and this is a radio show run by peers living with mental illness and substance use in Niagara. This episode we have lovingly titled, The Youth Today. Most of this episode is an interview with Mike Lethby, who's executive director of The Raft, a youth shelter located in St. Catharines but serving all of Niagara, and then also a homelessness prevention organization located in St. Catharines, but serving all of the Niagara region. So huge thank you to him. Following that, we're going to share some little moments from our Willow members about their experiences being young, just answering a question that we've posed to them. It's like a streeter, only we did it in an office. Thank you so much for coming to be part of Speak to It. Could you introduce yourself?
Yeah, so I'm Michael Lethby. I'm the executive director of The Raft. We're a youth serving organization. We serve the entire region of Niagara, and we focus primarily on housing.
And how do you define youth?
Youth for us is primarily 16 to 24. We do some programs, after-school programs, where we work with younger youth, but our main area of focus is 16 to 24.
How do you identify who's at risk of homelessness?
People identify themselves. So it's if you come looking for service, then that's the person that we're looking to serve. The Raft's primary service isn't mental health or addictions. It's really around housing. However, obviously, addictions and mental health factors heavily into the work we do.
And when I brought what you explained back to our group, they were actually really excited because I think the way that they see it, the Willow has a similar mindset in terms of supporting a kind of holistic well-being, but not actually being a mental health service organization. Right, right. They were excited to have you come in. We all were for that reason.
Well, I think there's a lot of, I think in the work of all good community-based work, the focus tends to get lost on the community, and we tend to focus too much on the work. And we realize that it's out of the community that the work kind of comes from. And we're a community-based program. And, you know, just the way not-for-profits have developed and the services developed, it's become much more transactional. It's very much like, you know, here's things. And we think somehow that things are going to be what it is that people need. It's just as if somehow people are just economic beings and not actually people. So really what we've kind of recognizing that, because we are very much a transactional also. We have rent subsidies. We give out food. We have rooms and beds. And so these are very transactional. You need something. We provide a thing. And then hopefully that thing is something that helps. But it doesn't really get to the human element of the work we do. And I think we tended to get lost in the more, like I said, the more transactional elements. And so over the last few years, we've really kind of been focusing back on, because we found that the transactional things, although important, you know, we live in a society where you need things to survive. No one can survive without anything. There is something lost for the vast majority of people, and especially people who have been marginalized. And it is that human connection. You lose community by being homeless. At the center of all homelessness is a loss of human connection. And it isn't necessarily the loss of housing. There's been many times where we've been able to get people into housing and the housing is broken down, not because there's anything necessarily wrong with the physical space, but because there was no human connection in the housing. It was just a room. And the people that they actually wanted to be with were on the outside of the room. And the housing actually ended up creating a barrier between them and the people that they wanted to be with. And so they would leave their housing to go be with people because that's the real power, right, of people and attachment. And so we figured if we really wanted to sort of end homelessness, it had to be more than just a transaction. It had to be a human connection, had to be a key element of the work that we're doing. And so it really is about making community part of the work and not just work. So that's where I see some a lot of similarities with the work. I mean, just as you've just explained with how the center runs and, you know, all the things you're doing. I mean, clearly it is, there's the activity, but the value is in the people in the room, not at the end of the day of producing a Mona Lisa or a, you know, some great piece of art. It really is in the people that are in the room doing the work. And that's, that shared experience is probably the value.
You've just explained it so well. I think what the Willow is going for also, like you say, is bringing people together. And that is across a table that might have paints or sculpture materials or radio equipment, but ultimately about bringing people together and uplifting them to be peer supporters for each other and those types of things. So giving space for that connection and then eventually uplifting people to then become facilitators and things like that, that give people some purpose.
just the most natural thing in the world. I mean, everybody's a peer support. That's really what friends are. I mean, we have these terms. I mean, it's just friendships and it's family and that's who my peer support people are. And so it's the most natural kind of relationship you can have.
Could you tell me specifically about a program or two and how they build relationships and attachments for young people?
This is a journey we're on. In no way do we think that we have the answer. We feel like we have an idea of what the answer looks like, and that's what we're moving towards. And it's kind of interesting. We started off very much in that transactional space and thinking that it was these things that were important. And so a lot of our programs started because of the way we approached it, we ended up having attachment involved without necessarily focusing the programs on attachment. And that's what we're trying to correct now, is we're trying to really center attachment in the program. But for example, so back in 2007, we had just opened up the shelter. We were at a different shelter. We had much smaller. It was a 10-bed shelter. We were constantly full. I had people lined up, never enough rooms. We never had enough food. It was very chaotic. And we weren't really doing very good service. We were just surviving. We were very much living the same lifestyle pretty much as the people who were coming to get service from us. We could barely keep our heads above water. And so we were lucky. We got a grant from the federal government, allowed us to move to a new facility, which actually had been purposely built as a shelter. So it's just over here on Center Street. It had been built as a woman's shelter, so Jillian's Place. It was beautiful, beautiful facility, already pre-designed. So everything was functional. It was an amazing experience to walk in there from the place we'd been, just because the other place, they literally tore it down when we left. So we get in there and we went from a 10-bed shelter to a 24-bed shelter. And very quickly, we ended up becoming full at 24 beds. And so I ended up with the exact same problem, nicer building, but exact same problem as I had when I was at the smaller shelter. And so we had to sort of, again, look, you know, we've gone through many times where we've had to sort of sit back and say, are we doing this right? What are we, do we really know what we're doing? Should we be doing something different? Things we thought we knew ended up not being true. And so through that reflective process, we realized that the majority of people who were actually staying in our shelter weren't actually from St. Catharines. And so we had thought, as a St. Catharines agency, that the majority of people, this is how assumptions inform program delivery without any verification, you get these things. And so we started looking and say, okay, well, 60% of the people accessing our shelter at that time had come from a community outside of St. Catharines, within the Niagara region, but outside St. Catharines. And so we thought, is there something we could do to help prevent people from having to come to the shelter in St. Catharines if you're in Fort Erie? Because it's quite a bit of a distance, especially if you don't have a car. I mean, I don't even know how well you'd be able to get from Fort Erie to St. Catharines now, even with the regional transit. I think it would still be a pretty good journey. I think it would take some planning. But definitely back in 2007, there was no way you were getting here. So what we found is that people suffered a lot of additional trauma just in the traveling. It's a very vulnerable time when you leave, especially a smaller community, moving to a larger community. And it isn't like you know what you're looking for here. You just know you can't stay where you are because you've just ran out of resources. So. And there's people who are, waiting. Especially when you're in when you work in social work or you work in this kind of the helping field, you're kind of geared and sort of dialed in on supporting people. And it's hard to imagine that there's actually people out there who are actually trying to harm you, intentionally for their own benefit. And that's why it's so hard sometimes to really do good programming, because you can't even imagine, let's just call it evil. For sake of it, because that's how I feel it. It really is the embodiment of evil, where people will actually use you to the point where they've used up everything about you physically, spiritually, have just taken all that from you to make themselves better or feed themselves. And it's hard because I don't think most people are geared that way. I think most people want to help. They see someone hurt, they naturally want to help them. And so just even trying to imagine combating that kind of those people in the world, but they are, and they're active. They're not waiting for people to fall into. They're not like the trolls under the bridge that are just waiting for people to stumble over the bridge. They're actively working to recruit. And so they go to places where people are who are vulnerable. And so I used to call it the bus station challenge, and that anyone could go to the bus station, watch an out-of-town bus come in, and you could tell people who were coming here to look for, maybe as a tourist, or someone who was coming into town but knew the town, versus someone who was just getting off the bus and didn't really know where they were going the minute they stepped off the bus. It's so easy to spot these people. And so people would literally wait at a bus terminal or other places where people would mingle, and that's how they'd introduce themselves. And they'd come in very friendly. They'd wear the face of someone who was just looking to have a good time or support or you know, let's go smoke a joint. Oh, you need a place to stay. You know, you can crash at my place. That's not a problem. Oh, you need a job. I can find you a job. And so, you know, that's how the conversations would begin. And then very quickly, you'd be being exploited by people. And then once they sort of had drained you of all your value to them, that's when you'd show up at my shelter. And so the kids who were coming from outside of our community, so people, the kids in St. Catharines kind of knew who we were. And so if they ran into trouble, they could just come to us. They kind of avoided that whole process, right? But 6% of the kids were actually coming from places outside of St. Catharines. And so we're very much vulnerable to people who are actively looking to do them harm. And so we thought, well, we need to do something better. And that's when we started working with a program. We developed a program called Youth Reconnect. We're able to determine that the majority of school age, so 16 to 19, had been in high school immediately prior to becoming homeless. And so, you know, anytime where you can, where you know where all the people you want to be talking to are gathered, that's a huge win, right, in the social services. So we started working with schools because after family, teachers are the next adults who are not just professionally responsible for the students, but there's teachers don't just get into teaching as a profession. It's really, for a lot of teachers, it's a calling, right? They're really educators. They're not just people who are collecting paychecks and, you know, teaching people how to read. That's really not the gig. And so they would see and really know who their students were more than just, like I said, what their marks were, or how good they did at tests. And so we were able to work with them to identify students who, through their relationship and their knowledge, could tell us, you know, there is some problems at home. The students' behaviors change. You could tell that they're, you know, they're not doing so well anymore. There's clearly something's going on. And so that's kind of the first sign of homelessness, right? That's the first breakdown. And so what we were able to do is identify those students. And then our staff were able to come into the school, everything being voluntary, obviously the student has to want to talk to us, but we could meet you in your school. So in Fort Erie, we could actually come to your school in Fort Erie and sit down with you at school with the teacher if you wanted, or, you know, other people that you wanted there, and just kind of see what was going on and start creating a plan for you just so that you could stay a student and stay housed.
It sounds like you're really empowering the youth in terms of that, allowing them to control who's present in the meeting, to assert that control about their own futures. And that sounds really like an important part of the program.
Well, that's the personal agency, right? There are programs where in order to participate, you have to be, it's like a head lease. So the agency actually is the tenant, and then they sublet the rooms to people. It's not a bad system. The problem I have with it is that people who move into the units aren't tenants, so they're not covered under the Landlord Tenancy Act. They're covered under something called the Innkeepers Act. And it really strips away a lot of rights that come from the legislation that you have as a tenant. And so that reduces personal agency, right? Anytime we take away someone's rights, we reduce their personal agency. And I don't think we can build people up by stripping them down. So yeah, so definitely personal agency, empowering, making sure that it's consensual, right? That this is what you want. Like, people want to live other lives. Like, I'm not here to say this is the only life you have to live. There's a life, I think, which has worked for me and worked for most people I know. Doesn't necessarily mean that's the life you want to live. And it's not for me to decide how you want to live your life. However, I do have a mission to try and keep you from being homeless. And so as long as it's homelessness isn't what you're trying to achieve, this is how we work with you. But it has to be through freedom of choice and personal agency.
And so when you have those meetings that the youth have directed, what happens after that?
So the youth continues to be a student. And then the staff does the work of trying to, we always start with family and friends. That's where we always go to. So what people probably largely, you know, there's a lot of talk right now about affordable housing. And affordable housing, for the work that I'm doing, is a bit of a red herring. Now, I'm not arguing ever that we don't need more affordable housing. That's not the argument. But the argument is, if you're looking for a program to support people who are homeless, affordable housing is never going to actually support homelessness. It can't. Affordable housing is a very middle class understanding of housing, and that it presupposes that you can afford something, right? When you have nothing, nothing is affordable. And so just by providing housing, affordable housing, if you have nothing, it doesn't matter, because if you can't afford it, it's not for you. It's for people who have things and are worried about not being able to afford it, but they have something, right? And so, and what is never mentioned in any of the conversations around affordable housing is that the largest provider of affordable housing in Canada and North America are families. families support more people into housing, often without charging rent, no restrictions, you can come and go often. You know, you can return. If you leave, you can come back, which pretty much every student knows who's ever gone away to school. You know, they don't suddenly become homeless when their term is up. They just move back home, right? So we really don't appreciate the role that family plays in housing, and just the fact that, and because families are in every community, that means that affordable housing is in every community, right? So it's not concentrated in Toronto. It's not concentrated. It's across. And so that's really where we start working is there a way back to family, or is there family conflict is the number one driver of youth homelessness. So, you know, it's about maintaining safe and appropriate, but it's still involving family, and that is the first option.
And so you're able to work with the families and to kind of build up those relationships?
Usually it's about setting boundaries. Although the word gets, you know, the stat is out there, and it's true in multiple studies, when youth who were homeless were asked what the reason for their homelessness was, it all came down to about 70, 75% family conflict. But when we look at what family conflict means, it's a pretty broad range of things. It could be as simple as not making your curfew, like if your parents have set a curfew or your guardian set a curfew and you constantly show up after the curfew. It could be smoking in your room, you know, which are pretty minor conflicts in the continuum of conflicts. That's a pretty minor. But for some people, enough of that will cause a person to say, well, you can't be under my roof kind of thing. And that's a road to homelessness, right? All the way up to the most horrific abuses, which I won't even get into, which are on the exact opposite side of the scale. But all of those things are contained within this term family conflict.
Yeah, but the vast majority are things that maybe actually have more simple solutions. It definitely sounds like your agency has a completely different way of thinking about homelessness, and that we all have a lot to learn in terms of how we understand the actual causes of it and the solutions. And so do you feel like this is a new and revolutionary approach?
It's kind of a funny question because, I mean, yes, I do feel our approach is quite novel, and I don't see it happening in a lot of places, and I see it works. So from that angle, but then the other side of the coin is that, isn't this how we've always been? Like, how novel is it that, you know, maybe we should talk to family? If it's, you know, or talk to teachers.
Well, just because it's natural, I guess, didn't mean that it was actually happening.
Well, that's what, like, how advanced thinking, like, it isn't rocket science, right? That's what is so amazing to me, is that it's the simplest of solutions.
You were talking about that kind of reflective way of thinking about your own practices and really open to thinking, we are doing this wrong. Mm-hmm. And that sounds like a really important part of your process.
And that works. We constantly are going through, we track a lot of data. So we feel we need to be accountable for the work we're doing. And too often in charity, it's too easy to blame people who don't succeed on personal failings. Like, they weren't able to succeed. You know, we did our best. They failed because of themselves. I think that's just an easy out. I think we really need to, anytime someone fails, it's the, we said we were going to help and somehow we didn't help. And so we need to look in the mirror and say, well, what didn't we do? It's not about celebrating successes. You know, often people succeed on their own. You know, we're just kind of there, not to minimize the work that the staff are doing, hard work, but, you know, the success and the work that my staff are doing isn't going to move the dial forward if people themselves don't step up. And it's really ultimately the individual success. We were just there to help. But the failings are usually on our side. Our programs weren't run in a way that people could utilize them. They were too structured in a way that stopped people from. They didn't address people's actual needs. We suggested, you know, and that's kind of what I was getting at the beginning when I was talking about, you know, the road to happiness. There's a way I think, you know, if people led a life this way, it leads to, but that's just how I feel. So if I design a program that sort of forces you into that and that ends up not being the way you want to achieve your life or live your life, well, then you're going to bump into the walls and ultimately fall out of the program. And then that looks like a failure. You know, is it your failure? Is it our failure for not addressing you? We open the door, we ask you to come in, and then we tell you what to do, as opposed to, you know, there's something on that just isn't, you know, just doesn't fit.
Just needing to listen to their needs and knowing that they understand what they need maybe better than
you do. And then looking to provide that, as opposed to coming up with a list of things and saying, okay, well, clearly you need this, this, and this. Yeah, and that's where it gets back to that transactional approach.
Do you see that there's a better future in Niagara?
I do. Absolutely. Yeah. I've seen it. You know, when I was talking earlier about that, when we opened the new shelter, That year, we had 500 individual youth come through that shelter. Last year, we had about 100. And so we've seen it's been sustained. We saw once we started our Youth Reconnect program, we've added some other programs. We've seen sustained reductions in youth homelessness to the point where Niagara actually has one of the lowest rates of youth homelessness in Canada. I've seen better, but we haven't seen best yet. And that's where we're still working towards. We understand better. We need to get best. And so that's what keeps us going.
I think maybe a lot of listeners will be surprised to hear that Niagara has one of the lowest rates in Canada.
People all across Canada, when youth homelessness is mentioned, they talk about Niagara. And it's the funniest thing because it's here, no one knows it. Your hometown never knows the work you're doing, but it's amazing. Like I said, you know, we're working with the province of New Brunswick on work in their strategy on how to work with youth homelessness. We're working with multiple agencies across Canada on how to develop through that common ground and other work we're doing. And yet in Niagara, it's sort of, I don't think we're very well known in Niagara, to tell you the truth.
Hopefully this little program can raise that profile a tiniest bit. And just because we're an arts organization, I just have one last question to wrap up. And I'm so happy to wrap up on such a positive note. Because we're an arts organization, do you see a role for art in youth well-being?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We've done programs and worked with other artists on different, because it's really about passion, right? And so anytime we can expose youth to passion, we think that's valuable, regardless of where the passion is. And so definitely, and arts has a tendency to be a passionate field. It gives people they see a future. It's aspirational. So absolutely, I think arts is a great place for people to sort of find their community.
Thank you so much for sharing this
absolute pleasure.
Amazing success story with us. No, and, you know, we're glad to hopefully build community here and to hear about the community that you're building at the Raft.
Best of luck. It's an absolutely wonderful program. Thank you.
Thank you. So we asked some members of the Willow to come into our little recording space and answer a couple of questions. And the first one is, what do you wish you could have told yourself as a young person or younger person, if they're still a youth? And then the second question was, if there's a message that you have for young people today who might be struggling or having a hard time. And I just noticed, I don't know if I realized at the outset how vulnerable we were asking people to be, but they really opened their hearts and I'm really happy to share what they shared with us.
I would say, don't be afraid to fail. There's so many things I wish I'd pursued when I was younger and not yet bogged down by the responsibilities of adult life. But at the time, I felt frightened and unprepared to try new things, as if for some reason I needed to become an expert on something before I felt safe enough to try it. Part of this has to do with the fact that, at the time, I often felt foolish or stupid as a result of undiagnosed ADHD, and not yet realizing that, regardless of why I was different from others, that it was okay to be that way. I was and still am very self-conscious, but I definitely tell my younger self that all these fears I had about others judging me at that age were, first of all, often unfounded or otherwise inconsequential. I promise that no one cares about what you're doing, except for the right kind of people, of course. And as for the kids today, honestly, the kids these days are all right. I'm truly impressed by the awareness and commitment to social responsibility that seems to be coming from the younger generation. So I guess I'd say never stop fighting the good fight and know that support is here if you need it. You just have to reach out to your elders.
I would say that I know things are really hard right now, and I know you don't have any answers, and I know it feels like nobody around you understands anything that you're going through, but one day you will see that all of these hard things are actually just lessons in disguise, and that there is a peaceful, more purposeful, joyful, amazing life for you that's coming, but you just have to get through these lessons first before that happens. But it's at the end, waiting for you.
What I wish I could say to myself as a young person is just to listen to the thoughts that I have about myself. So just to be aware of my self-talk and learn and understand that positive self-talk is so important, because I didn't even notice that I don't think I had any positive self-talk until I was about 30 years old. And I think that would have really helped me a lot. And then to young people today, I would say the same thing. Listen to what you're telling yourself inside of your own mind, because you are completely in control of that voice. And it might not feel like it, and thoughts come at you from all over the place of things that you've internalized from your family, from negative people in your life and just get rid of it, cut it out. And when it plays again, just stop it again and play something different. Play something about how wonderful and amazing and awesome you are, or how wonderful and awesome and amazing you will be soon because you make it true.
I think the main thing would probably be like, just go for what you want to do. Don't like purposely hold yourself back, because I did that a lot. And like, especially in like the arts kind of thing, don't be scared of messing up, because you're gonna mess up. And that's just how it is, because you got to mess up before you can do something great.
I would love to say to my younger self, stay weird. Keep making art. Don't let the world convince you otherwise, because the weirdest and most unique things about you are the things that make you magical. Like a similar thing of like, just really lean into the things that you love and that make you different. They're not the bad things about you, they're the best things about you.
As much as you may feel invincible, you're not. Be kind to yourself in any and every aspect imaginable. Trust me, you'll thank me later. Paint, draw, sketch, write, whatever, just be yourself and the world will love and accept you for it. Some may disagree, but who cares? Screw the naysayers. Stay positive, refrain from any negativity that may come to mind.
The first thing I would say is it's okay. It's okay to cry. It's okay to feel. It's okay to care. It's okay not to care. It's just gonna be okay. Like, as long as you put an effort in, it's gonna be okay. That's definitely what I would say. People gotta understand, like, when you rush through things, you're not getting nowhere. Take your time. Take time, think first. Treat life like a precious glass of water. If you drink it too fast, you know it's gonna hurt. It hurts to go down, and it takes a minute to clear up. So take your time with life.
I wish I would have understood that I can belong to myself, that there were times and spaces and places that I didn't maybe feel like I belonged to the people around me, but to know that I could belong to myself. I would say, like, trust that it can get better. Trust that people have come before you and got better, and that you too can get better, and that the world can be a dark and scary and mean place, but to look for the joy and to look for the places that support you, that feel good to you. There are places and people that will feel like home.
Thank you for tuning into this episode. We're so grateful for you listening and for the honesty and vulnerability of our guests. Special thanks to all of them: Lisa, Sam, Evan, Sarah, Queens One, and Mike Lethby. And thanks to the folks who helped make this episode possible: Allison Carroll, Trisha Franklin, Lee McLeod, me, Daya Lai, James Webb, and Richie Webb. Thanks for listening.
This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada in cooperation with CFBU 103.7 FM.